The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And this is going to be an interesting one. I'm joined by Brian Mossoff. And when you look at his bio, entrepreneur, angel investor, words like blockchain, cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin comes up. But Brian was introduced to me by a mutual friend as being a real wine fanatic. I've emailed back and forth with them, and we were talking about it before, and it's certainly true. And it's one thing I want to do with this podcast. It's not just winemaker psalms. It's people that just have an interesting story who also have a passion for wine, much like a lot of the people that are listening to this podcast right now are. Brian, thank you so much for doing this. I appreciate it.
Any excuse to drink and talk wine, I'm there. I'm here.
Do you get tired of it always talking about just, you know, the world that you're in? Because, and we'll get into it, but when I say words like blockchain, cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin, that goes over a lot of people's heads, including my own. So I imagine a lot of times you're trying to explain to people what the hell it is that you do.
I think people are trying to also explain what the big deal is about wine and why you would pay more than $15 for a bottle of something.
Yeah.
I think I'm a fortunate person that I've surrounded myself with things that I'm very passionate about. And whether it's my daytime job or a hobby of chatting wine with people or exploring or traveling a wine region, I'm passionate about it. I will talk at length, at nauseam, to whoever is willing to listen and share in that passion. I'm there. So I don't really ever get bored of it. I'm not bored of ever drinking and tasting wine and exploring wine. And it's one of those things, you know, as most wine fans know, that the more you learn, the more you taste, the more you realize, wow, there's a whole world out there of grapes I've never heard of, yep. Regions, producers, little sub-appellations, and that's what's exciting. I was recently on a business trip in Prague, and I decided to take the weekend in Paris, and I would just, other people are out seeing the Eiffel Tower, they're visiting the sites. I'm just going wine bar to wine bar,
oh, yeah.
Saying, what's the weirdest thing you have here? Show me a producer who I've never heard of, these little tiny weird experimental wines. That's what I'm excited about. And I don't remember where I was going with this train of thought.
Well, actually, it's funny. You went to wine. I was asking you to get tired of talking about your day job.
Oh, damn.
Yeah.
Do you get tired? I just went right to wine.
You went right to wine. But I want to get to your day job a second. But you are right about, like, I love going, anytime I'm in Europe, it's just go to the wine bars.
Find the wine bar.
And especially just the ones of the largest by the glass program, and let me try something different that I can't get here. And I tell people all the time, if you want to learn about wine, go to wine bars, try things you don't normally get to try, and it's a perfect way to just sort of educate yourself about what's out there and also what you like and don't like.
Yeah, and I was in, I think it's called Lavinia, which is a big wine shop in Paris. I think it's one of the biggest in France or in Europe. It's not the biggest wine store in Europe, but in France, it's certainly one of the biggest. And it went into the glass room where they've got all the special bottles and Okay, here's some fantastic Vouvray. Like, okay, I've seen all this stuff before. And then I see this thing that says Clos Joliette. Mm-hmm. And I point to it and go, what the heck is that? And the girl comes over and she's like, oh, that is something special. And I'd never heard of Clos Joliette before. And I ended up buying both bottles and bringing them back. It's Petit Mansang, and I haven't opened either of them yet, and I'm really excited just to see what that is. That's the fun, is to see what's in that bottle.
Yeah.
Supposedly, I don't know too much about Clos Joliette, but apparently the producer died and it hasn't been produced in a number of years. And the daughters, I think, inherited the winery, but don't want to be winemakers, but won't sell it to someone outside of the appellation.
Yeah.
So it's kind of sitting at the standstill. But as I would go around Paris and I would go into these wine bars and they said, have you bought anything so far? And I said, okay, I have a 1990 Fleury Champagne. They're like, okay, that's pretty good. I got this, that, or whatever. They said, fine. And then I'd show them a picture and they go, oh, you got a bottle of Clos Joliette.
That's your street cred. That's your wine street cred. When you have that for the people in the industry, like, oh, okay. Anyone can go to Paris and buy champagne. You're an hour and a half.
Totally.
You're an hour and a half away from it by car. But you know, when you're getting some of the more funky stuff, yeah, that's a different world.
And the funky stuff is what I get drawn to. And this kind of ties a little bit into cryptocurrency, which is I'm drawn to the unknown. I like exploring. I like asking questions. I'm an inquisitive person. I've always been since I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And I remember being in San Francisco a few months ago, and Shav is one of my favorite producers in Rhone. And I'm walking by their, you know, locked cabinet, whatever. And there's this mini bottle, half bottle. It says, you know, it says the producer's name. I go, what the heck is this?
Yeah.
Vende pipe. Like, what? What is this half bottle? He goes, oh, yeah. About 9 times in the last 50 or so years, 60 years, they've produced a dessert wine.
Really? I didn't even know Shav did a dessert wine.
Well, I don't think that they really do.
No.
I think it's a kind of, one year the grapes are right and let's take Marsan and let's produce it. And it's in very small quantities. It's under 1,000 bottles, I think, every time he does it. The last time it happened was, I think, in 2000. And I got the 1990, and it was fairly expensive. Where I said, I don't know. I'm going to come back.
Yeah.
And I asked the guy, have you ever tasted this? Have you ever seen this before? And he said, it's probably the only bottle that exists in the U.S. And I went on Wine Searcher later, and I went, well,
that's it.
He wasn't lying. It's the, you know, one bottle in Flatiron in San Francisco. So I went back the next day, and I picked it up.
Still there?
It was still there. I picked it up. I figured, I gotta take this thing and at some point open it just to see what it is. And in some quick reading online that I've done, and I mean to do more, a lot of people are saying, you know, this is kind of a unicorn wine. It's a once in a lifetime thing to taste what that is.
Yeah.
And I'm super curious, and that's what I'm drawn to. And that's kind of with cryptocurrency, what drew me to it is, what the heck is this thing? And my exposure to it came from a friend of mine buying a used iPad off Craigslist. We take a drive out to Mississauga, and this is in, I guess, 2012. And the guy who's selling the iPad is trying to sell us his BMW M3. And he says, do you want it? I'm selling everything I own for Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And I look at my friend Dean and go, what the heck is a Bitcoin? There's probably some profanity thrown in there. I don't know if swearing's allowed on your show.
Yeah, you can swear. We do a little bit. There's not.
It might have been funnier if I said it with an F-bomb. But anyway, we say, what the heck is a Bitcoin? We leave there, and like a lot of people in the cryptocurrency space, they hear about it, they have some exposure to it in whatever area it pops up on the internet, they meet someone who's talking about it, they're not overly interested in exploring it, and they put it in a drawer, and then it keeps popping up, and you eventually decide to do a little bit of reading on it, and that's pretty much what happened to me. Starting in early 2013 or later 2012, I start really doing a deep dive into what is this? What is Bitcoin? Who cares? Why is it a big deal? What problem does it solve? Why is there this very passionate, energetic, charged community that's rallying around this thing and on Reddit 24 hours a day arguing about how the issuance should work or how scaling will work? And you kind of just fall into that rabbit hole too. Wine rabbit hole. Crypto rabbit hole.
So explain just what Bitcoin is. And also, it seemed like for a couple of years, everyone, as you said, was yelling and screaming about it. And then it suddenly went away. And I haven't heard anything about Bitcoin in the last year or so. And then we'll discuss the 83 Bordeaux that I opened up.
I just took a sip. I pulled the mic away when I took my sip. I didn't know how much sound of that you wanted.
And by the way, I'm still fighting about how closely should when I'm sipping wine and doing the whole thing that I do when I'm assessing it, how close should I have my mouth to the mic? Because I'm like, oh, that's gross.
I did a little pullback.
I did a pullback.
I thought it was polite.
Brian is very polite of you.
It's so, very polite to do the pullback and not do the sound right into the mic. People might appreciate that.
Yeah, so just, you know, for dummies like myself, because you're an angel investor, so obviously time, energy, money went into it. Exactly. Just what?
Who cares? What's the big deal here?
And where is it now?
Yeah. So I think very quickly, the thing that Bitcoin solved that people who are just looking at it as a currency are kind of missing a bit of the point here, and that is that in the real world, if I hand you a few dollars, you know that I lost those dollars and you got them. There's what's called no counterparty risk. You don't have to trust me or a bank or someone else to facilitate that transfer.
Because I'm holding it. I'm holding
it. You're holding it. You don't care who I am. The thing that you trusted was the dollar.
Yeah.
And when you do this in a computing environment, it's a problem because the internet and just the way that hard drives work, the sender doesn't lose a copy of the information when you receive it. Yeah. You're just duplicating the data. So an easy way to think of this is when you download or watch something on YouTube, you're just getting a copy of that video. YouTube hasn't lost their copy.
Right.
Everyone can understand that.
Yeah.
And so for pretty much as long as computers have existed, this is what there's two terms for it. The easier one is just the double spend, which is how do you know that when the dollar was sent that the sender lost the money, they didn't spend it 5 minutes earlier, they didn't make five copies of whatever the thing is that they gave to you. That sender has to lose the thing in the transfer.
Yeah.
And it was thought to be an impossible problem to solve, and you would have to have some kind of trusted third party to facilitate the transaction. So enter Visa, PayPal, MasterCard, Interact, whoever it is.
Yeah, to facilitate.
Yeah, exactly. To facilitate the transfer. And it makes it expensive. It makes it slow. And you have to trust a third party. And it leaves a few billion people in the world excluded from this system. And in 2008, a white paper surfaces in some cyberpunk forums. And it's called Bitcoin, an idea for a peer-to-peer cash digital system. I'm probably getting the title a little bit wrong, but you get the idea.
I knew what it was, but I didn't want to embarrass you. Yeah.
Anyway, they basically, whoever it was, solved that problem and also invented this thing called crypto economics. And it's essentially a way for unknown parties to come to consensus on the state of a ledger without having to trust one another. That's the big deal. That's what everyone's so excited about. And it basically makes cash a potential native feature on the internet. And right now, it's not a native feature. It's something that's kind of being shoved in there through credit cards, but it doesn't really work and is clunky, and there's security risks. And so there's big deal things that can happen because of this. And that's why everyone's so excited. And so Bitcoin was the first one, and then people cloned it and tweaked it and came out with Litecoin and Peercoin and variations of it.
Yeah.
And the next big leap forward was something called Ethereum. And Ethereum basically said, well, if you put a code base into a blockchain, and instead of having a great calculator, what happens if you have a world computer? What kind of things can you do then? What happens when the money can truly become programmable? And everyone got more excited. And that's basically where I quit everything in life and decided this is what I'm going to do. And now I'm the CEO of Ether Capital. And I basically don't stop talking crypto all the time, unless it's someone puts a wine bottle in front of my face.
All right, then we're gonna bounce back and forth. And also, I want to talk about, because yeah, we were talking off before we started just about how you and New World wines and California wines don't mesh, and that's
why?
A whole. That's,
why am I so snobby?
But the thing is my but problem? Hold on. Okay, let's go there first. Then I don't look at it necessarily as snobby because, as I say on this podcast all the time, if you like everything, you love nothing. There are 24 hours in a day. You're not going to be into everything. If someone says they don't like Molson Canadian, they prefer craft beer. No one calls them a beer snob. You don't like gamey meats. You prefer steak. Or I don't like steak. I like gamey meats. No one applies the term snob. But with wine, the word snob comes up all the time.
One plus though of being a wine snob is somehow the word alcoholic goes away.
That is
with
true.
All other alcohol, it's, yeah, oh, they drink all the time. They're an alcoholic. With wine, oh, he's really into wine. Somehow it's more socially acceptable.
Yeah. Oh, that's true. You're right. Alcoholic doesn't get used anymore.
No.
It's like you know, back in the day, famous actors, they're like, oh yeah, you know, this leading man loved the ladies, which basically meant he cheated on his wife all the time. But we just, you know, would just wrap it around, I love the ladies. He was a ladies man versus, no, actually he ruined his marriage and he cheated on her and that's why they got divorced.
I wanted to throw in there, the funny part is, I guess I can ask you a question here. What was the bottle of wine that made you realize there's something more going on here than just the box wine that you drank while you were growing up and couldn't afford anything in school? What most people have a bottle that the light bulb went off.
It's
what
funny. Was it? I ask that question to all my guests.
I'm flipping it around. I'm your first non-wine native person, so I get to ask a question here.
Yeah, yeah. It was an old Barolo. It was brick orange in color. My stepdad, a friend of his, who used to be the head of the police union, also was a big fan of wine. And him and a bunch of friends would always, once every 6 months, would like get together, bring lots of good wine, cook lots of food, and have just a great night. And I got to be a part of it. And poured me the glass. It looked gross. I'm like, what the hell is this? You know, wine is not supposed to be this color.
It's supposed to be black.
It's supposed to be
inky purple.
Inky purple.
And 20 grams of residual sugar with no grape listed on the bottle.
Yeah, exactly. Just a blend.
A brand.
Yeah.
Red blend.
Red blend. Which technically, actually, what we're drinking now is a red blend because it's Bordeaux.
That's also true.
Yeah. But I tried it and I started to laugh because it was so good and I got goosebumps and I immediately like just filled the glass right to the brim and I wanted to tell everyone to get out, leave right now because I need to know what the hell is this. So that's really what started, kick-started my love of wine.
That's a pretty good first bottle.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, I wish I remember what the label or wrote it down. But, you know, I was in my early 20s, early to mid-20s, so, you know.
I didn't grow up as a wine drinker, but I was part of a film production company at the time where my partner and his father were very into wine, and they would open a bottle of, I mean, maybe at some point I got to try DRC, and I didn't get it.
Yeah.
To me, I don't know, wine.
And by the way, to the listeners who don't know, I bet most of you do, DRC, Domaine Roman Conti. It's basically the
most terrible.
It's the most expensive wine on planet Earth. It's Pinot Noir, Burgundy. It's considered the gold standard by which all other wine is held to. Whether you believe that or not, or your own personal taste, it's a big bleeping deal.
Yeah, I don't know that what I got to try was Romani Conti, Hill. For anyone who doesn't know, it could have been, you know, Echoiseau or whatever it is, but I didn't get it.
Tough. You were stuck with Latache.
Yeah, but my point here is that it wouldn't have mattered if they gave me the Yellowtail or the DRC.
Yeah.
I didn't know the difference, and I wanted to understand what the big deal was. Why are people so excited by this? Why are they paying, like I said earlier, more than $15 for a bottle of wine?
Yeah.
Who cares?
Yeah.
And it was at the Christmas party that year, the next year, I don't know, where they had... Sorry. It was a bottle of Two Hands Bella's Garden Shiraz 2008.
Yep.
And for whatever reason, I noticed that something was different about that wine than the other wines that I had had. It was probably pretty big and a little chocolatey, so, you know, heavy oak, high alcohol. But it was the first time I ever said, "Oh, I kind of like this. I'm gonna have a little bit more." And I went out and bought a few bottles of it. And it was expensive for me at the time. It was, I think, I don't know, $65.
Yeah.
So that was kind of the first bottle that not quite an aged Barolo, but it was the first bottle where I went, something more is going on here than just the cheap stuff that I've. I guess I'm Jewish, so Manischewitz wine, which I don't even. What is Manischewitz wine? How do you describe that?
It's a syrupy mess is what Manischewitz is. Manischewitz tastes like, it's like Concord grapes.
It tastes like... It's a freezy.
Yeah, it tastes like the juice I had as a kid when I would go home for lunch.
That's what I had growing up on Friday night dinners. So a bit of a jump from that to the Bella's Garden Shiraz. And then I did the George Brown Intro to Wines 1 course. And the next leap here was... I think a lot of people have this experience where they line up for you, call it, you know, 3-4 whites. We were talking about this before. A Riesling, a Sancerre, you know, an Alsatian Riesling, so dry. There'll be a Sancerre. There's a, I don't know, Gewürztraminer.
Yeah.
And they're asking basic questions. You know, does anyone smell this, you know, in this glass? And when you go for the first time, you kind of shrug your shoulders and go like, sure, maybe if you say so. I don't know. Like, maybe that's in there. And then I would go and buy those bottles. I'd go and buy those bottles from the LCBO and I would drink them throughout the week, but I'd always drink them side by side.
Yeah.
I would do the same thing. Put down 3 glasses and have a glass of each and think about those tasting notes that someone was describing to you. And at some point that light bulb goes off where you go, you know, there is kind of this grassy thing going. I mean, I can recognize that they're different, but the vocabulary isn't there yet. And the light bulb goes off and you go, yep, there is something grassy going on in that Sancerre. There is this kind of pink grapefruit, high acid thing, and the Riesling's got this petrol note. And that was really fun that you could identify that these things are different and you can articulate why they're different. And that's where the rabbit hole really opens up.
Yeah.
Because all I want to do now is taste and compare. And even to this, sorry, last point.
Yeah.
Even to this day, when I go to a wine bar in Paris, I don't order in ones. I order in threes. And I carry around a notebook and I make notes on everything. And I get a lot of my bills comped actually because of this, because they think I'm a master of song or something. Because
you're in the industry.
I can speak the lingo and they can see that I'm passionate about it. And they're wondering, why is this guy ordering 3 to 5 glasses at a time? And to me, that's the way to taste, is you get to compare what's going on over here that isn't happening over there. Which one do I prefer?
And I hope people listening, and people come, you know, you might not be able to afford to do it at the level that Brian is. But at the same point, that's like the good thing is about three or four times you've already used the word fun to describe wine, which is what it's supposed to be. And if you can do it, or if you're out with a friend and you're both,
don't order the same thing.
Order something different and order and try just that little compare and contrast, you know.
I'm raising my hand here for a question.
Yeah.
Or one thing I notice is if you talk to either the somm there or the waiter and you say, can you just split the one glass into two half glasses and get two different wines? At first, maybe there's some resistance. No, we don't really do half glasses here. But if they detect that you want to do it because you're wanting to learn and understand.
A good wine bar will do it.
But even regular restaurants, I find, once they detect why you want to do it and you say, we just want to put them side by side just to see what's happening, they'll almost always say yes.
It's a great, that's a really good tip. It is. And, you know, and try doing different things, like grab a Riesling from Ontario, grab a Niagara, the Black Sheep Featherstone Riesling. It's under $17. And then put that up against a Moselle, and you can get a decent Moselle Riesling for, you know, $18 to $24. And at least that's a pretty good representation of it, and see the difference between the two. And if you do that, then you'll start to learn, and then if you're into it, then you'll just want to learn more and more about what the hell it is in my glass. It's a really good thing to do.
Yeah, and a lot of people, I think, like to go with what they know, and they typically order the same thing. I kind of always encourage my friends to try something that you've never had before. And again, if you're doing it in half glasses, fine. If you want whatever you're familiar with, you know, a Napa cab is common with my friends. I work kind of in the banking area, so they like these big wines. But I'll also say, why don't you just get a half of that and a half of this and just put them side by side. See how it pairs better with your food. You know, the sushi that you're having, maybe you don't need a J.Lore Seven Oaks cab against your very delicate, light sushi. Let's try this and just see what happens.
You know, it's funny. I did a podcast.
That combination is funny.
Yeah. Oh, no. I'm going right into that. I was interviewing the head somm for the Shore Club, and we talked about this in the podcast that was released a little while ago, back in January 10th. She had the term, it's called the Bay Street pairing, and it was Cabernet Sauvignon with a seafood tower. And it was Napa Cabernet Sauvignon, the seafood tower. And it's your silver oak with your silver fish, you know, and it's just that combination. So let's go there. Let's go there. And at some point, we're going to discuss the wine we're drinking. 1983 Chateau de la Marque. It's from Haute Médoc. It's not one of the five growths, but this is a really good, consistent producer. And this wine's from 1983. And this is still filled with
very
life.
Much together.
I mean, this is a 35. And it's not like a, you know, 35-year-old Chateau Latour. This is Chateau de la Marque, and good for them because there's still lots of life in there. There's lots of acid.
It's the beauty of Bordeaux.
Yeah.
These things don't die.
No. Oh, no. But what is, like, just, we're going to delve into generalities here, generalizations. But stereotypes exist because they are based in a place of truth. And with Bay Street, it's very much cake bread, Camus on a special night, Opus One, things like that. You're in that world. Why do you think that just, and it's usually men of a certain demographic that always go there.
I don't think, so in fairness, first of all, there's really nothing wrong with liking any of these wines.
Oh, no,
everyone
no.
has to
oh,
drink what they like.
So
I'll say that as the stamper, you know, on top of everything we're going to talk about right now.
A fantastic point. These wines, and I've visited Cake Bread, and I've visited Opus One. Like, there's a lot of pride and attention, and these are great wines. And you know, that's right, it's a good point. It's more that it seems that it's predictable what the order is going to be.
It is. And I guess the thing that I should say here, or my thought is that it's not really limited to Bay Street. It's just that Napa in particular has done an incredible job at marketing themselves over the last 30 years. Just incredible. I mean, every one of my friends knows what J.Lore Seven Oaks Cab is.
Yep.
If I ask them to name a single Bordeaux, they can't do it.
Because Bordeaux's more work. Because Bordeaux doesn't say, like, nowhere on this label does it say what we're drinking.
That's right.
Yeah, versus what is like in most New World countries.
And France has a bit of this problem where they've divided up, you know, this region, this is what you grow. And they just expect you to know that if it says this appellation, this is what's going to be in the bottle. I mean, other than obviously a few places like in Alsace where there's a few different white grapes, so they will list what the grape is. But for the most part, you have to work more in France. And they see it as, this is tradition. We're not going to change our labeling to help some people across the ocean figure out that anytime you see, you know, Sancerre and it's white, it's going to be Sauv Blanc.
Yep.
Figured out. It's not that hard. Hundreds of years, we've never made anything else that's white that's not Sauv Blanc. That's not going to change. And so I think people have this tendency to say, well, I know what Argentinian Malbec is. I know what Napa Cab is. It's big. It's flavorful. And so all that happens, whether they're on Bay Street or they're just wanting to spend 20 or 30 bucks on a bottle of wine, whatever it is, they still just kind of go for what's familiar. They're just willing to spend more on a bottle or more refined producer or whatever it is, but they're still sticking to the same grape in combination and flavor profile, and they're not branching out. And I don't think that really has anything to do with Bay Street.
No, you know what it has to do with?
It's just people.
What it has to do with is it's not about geography, about Bay Street. It's about the emotion of intimidation.
Totally.
Wine can be intimidating.
Yeah. And there's a reason I get a Big Mac combo every time I go to McDonald's. Mm-hmm. I'm familiar with it. Yep. I like it.
Yep.
It's very hard to sway me off getting that Big Mac combo. I mean, I'm making a joke here, but I'm dead serious. I will always get the Big Mac combo. And so.
What would you pair it with?
Big Mac.
So I go Merlot. I go with a good, well-made New World Merlot. That's what I'm throwing with that Or you know, if we're gonna go old world, you know, maybe something a little spicy, you know, maybe get maybe a little Cornas going there, a little 100% Syrah.
That could be the move to do something Northern Rhone. The thing that I was thinking right now is that the Big Mac is so flavorful that it's going to blow a lot out of the water. And what I was wondering is, first of all, there's something funny about drinking champagne with McDonald's, just the dichotomy of these.
Oh, I'd have it with their French fries,
and
I would have champagne with the McDonald's French fries.
And people don't drink enough champagne or Cremant. If you want to spend just $20 on a bottle,
yeah,
go pick up some Cremant. And I wonder if,
man, I yell about that all the time. This pod, the amount of times I brought up Cremant on this podcast,
just drink Cremant.
Yeah,
stock bottles of it. It's so cheap and it's so good.
Good stuff for under $20. You can get stuff for $19
Yep. Yeah, and it's fun to say, oh, it's from Alsace, it's from Bordeaux. I mean, it's hard to find. I don't think there's a lot of Bordeaux Cremant that floats in the LCBO, but you do see...
Got a lot of the Burgundy. There's a lot of good Burgundy.
A lot of Burgundy.
Ones,
yeah. I think Alsace, Loire, we've seen a couple times. But it's great stuff to have kicking around. And, you know, champagne to me, I like really good champagne, which also to me requires some age on it.
Yep.
You're not finding that in the LCBO. This is, I think a lot of people have this frustration that getting things in general with age through the LCBO, basically impossible unless it's a massive producer where they're going to do some purchasing program and it's going to come through classics.
Yeah.
And that's great. And sort of dive into the LCBO bit for a second here.
Now go.
The awesome part of the LCBO is that you know what you're getting is being backed by or came directly from the producer.
Yes.
Fantastic. Quality control, unparalleled. However, access to weird things is very limited. How many Etnas can we get in the LCBO?
Very few. Etna, by the way, giant mountain, the big mountain in Sicily, and it's right now a hot spot for wine. They make fantastic wines, and that's why you need consignment companies. What we're drinking now, I got this from a consignment company. This is not stuff I got from the LCBO.
And you're saying that, oh, by the way, Etna, as you said, that it's a hot region right now. It is maybe hot, but it's still really undervalued.
Mm-hmm.
There's some great stuff coming out of Etna, and I kind of think of it as almost an this is a weird description, but it's kind of an in-between of Burgundy and a Barolo.
Oh, no,
for
no,
me,
no.
It kind of falls in between these two categories.
Absolutely does. Absolutely. There's tons from there that's like a baby. It's like a baby Barolo.
Yeah.
You know, or a baby Barolo.
A little softer. A little more earthiness going on there.
Yeah.
But finding a great Etna in the LCBO is really tricky. It's very limited. And finding some of that more obscure stuff, not a ton of dessert wine selection. I like a lot of sweet stuff. And I get it. It's not popular.
It doesn't sell.
How many Sauternes? I mean, Ikem will always be sitting there. That's fine. That's great. But it's tough. I think you had on your podcast 2 weeks ago or a few weeks ago, Carrie.
Yeah, Carrie Mortimer.
Yeah, so she's the one who actually put me into the sherry rabbit hole.
Yeah.
I should give a shout out to her and thank her for the trip to Spain, in particular to Jerez and going all around that region, sherry sampling. And the funny part is that I can joke that at the LCBO, there's very little sherry representation happening there.
Yeah.
The sad thing is that being in that region, no one's there. No one's there.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Osborne. I went to Hidalgo. No one's on these tours. I had private tours of everywhere that I went. And
it's weird. Sherry, it's not the cool thing. And I sound like an old person. I go, is that the cool thing with the kids? Like, but it's not. Like Sherry, and Sherry's great. I love Sherry.
People have this idea that it's the cream sherry cream that came out of the 50s or the 60s. I don't even know what the cream sherry is that everyone Harville's thinks Bristol it
cream,
is.
Which, by the way, I enjoy a good cream sherry, but no, just the good phenos, the good dry stuff that's out there. You know, it's awesome. But no, people don't drink a lot of sherry.
The thing that people need to try, first of all, is just try it.
Yeah.
But second to that, pheno is tough because pheno has this really bizarre flavor profile. It's kind of like someone mixed olive brine with 25% apple juice.
Yep.
And the first time you have it, you go, this is weird. I don't get it. I don't know if I like it, if I hate it, if I want to gag. It takes a few runs at it, I think, to start appreciating it.
But have it with almonds, some cheese, and some olives, and you're doing
fine.
Start
pairing it with the right food, and it's fantastic. The thing that I think is more accessible... People are afraid of sweet wines for some reason. The reaction is always, oh, it's really sweet. You go, yeah, that's nice. How about you just focus on, do you like it? Is it interesting? Do you like the port? Do you like the Sauternes? Whatever it is. But I've given a number of friends Oloroso.
Mm-hmm.
That is something that can pull people into the rabbit hole. You know, it's a little bit nutty. The back of your throat is like almond skin, and it lasts really long, and it's not sweet. And people... They don't know what to make of it, but they know that they like it, and it's not what they thought it was going to be.
Oh, no. You give them good sherry. They're always shocked by it.
I just had, there was that 67 PX that was sitting around, and I just had that with, I paired it with creme brulee that I made, and it was incredible. It's PX, and it's kind of because of the... age on it, it was kind of like someone threw a pile of wet mud in there too, but in the best kind of way. Maybe that sounds gross to a lot of people, but I
it's good. All right, Brian. So next two things we want to do. First, we're going to describe the wine. Then I want you to explain to me what blockchain is. I hear that word.
I thought we just did that.
No. We're coming
pour me some more before we.
We're coming back to it, just because you know for people listening, they want to know a little bit about your world as well, because. It's a unique world. It's a different sort of world. So first, what do you get with the wine? Again, it's 35-year-old, well-made Bordeaux, really good producer, Chateau de la Mac. But it's not one of the five. It's not a growth wine, but it's damn good.
The thing that surprises me with it, as you said, is it's very much alive. I thought it would be more of that kind of just barely any fruit left going on. There's still. A bit of that kind of licorice, really dark cherry, dark plum going on the nose. It's fairly little bit of earth when you first poured it. I don't think I would call it bready, but there was some cigar box going on. Like that oak was really prevalent, at least when it first hit the glass, which I always love that smell. It reminds me of like stuff from kind of the Medoc region. Hold on.
I will say, as you're tasting, I was worried at first. I get a little bit, a tiny bit, like for me, when Bordeaux gets too old, I get like sulfur, and there's a lot of wines, so it's sulfur, or like if you take a match, light a match, pour it, just dip it in water, and then put it on your tongue. And I don't know why any human being would do that, but there is some of that. And I get a tiny trace.
It's a tiny bit there. But
a tiny trace, but... It's way in the background. It's way in the background.
The tannins have really soft. I mean, the tannins are there.
Yeah.
We're still medium or medium plus going on here, but they're really soft and silky, which is really nice.
Well, I'm happy with this wine. It's my last bottle of it. And I knew, like, it's not getting better. Like, there's no more room for growth, but it's still in a really nice place, which is what I appreciate about this wine.
Tannins are really there. Wow.
Yeah. Oh, yeah,
they're building. I mean, I haven't been drinking that much as we've been going along, but
yeah.
It's still very much alive, as you said. And, I mean, it's unfortunate we don't have a steak or anything right now. I don't know that I'd go Big Mac, but...
No, I would not go Big
Mac. But this wine is... So you got this from off consignment.
Oh, yeah. Got this from consignment. I wish I remember the name. I'll try to give a shout-out to it when I record either an intro or an extra of this later, because I buy from a bunch of different consignment companies.
What is your experience on consignment versus auction?
Auction has the greater opportunity because you can get stuff at a far cheaper price depending on who's there, at what point is it going on the auction. I was able to buy a bunch of 1972 Mouton Rothschild, and I spent a lot for them, but I spent around $550 a bottle. Now, that's a lot, which is, by the way, for people listening, that's both crazy low and crazy high. That's more money than I would, I usually ever spend on wine. Now, what I did with it was one bottle I shared with my dad, who at the time was like 81, 82. Another bottle I shared with my stepdad, who has opened up more great wine for me than any other human being. And then the third bottle I had on my own when I was closing my cottage. And so, like, I treated them all with the level of respect that something that wine deserves. And at that price point, and those bottles were all alive, but I have had some good, like, some Pio Cesari old Barolos that weren't even a little off. They were garbage. Like, this was just batshit, cat shit, horrible wine.
Yeah, it's just spill.
And it felt like whoever had it before me was leaving it in the sun all day.
I've had some E&E Shiraz that an old neighbor of mine bought in six bottles, and I think five out of the six just spill down the sink.
So there is a risk. It's risk reward. With consignment companies, I've had mostly great success. I'm a member of a place called the National Club, and they every now and then would sell off some of their old Bordeaux's, and it's almost 100% hit rate there.
I think it was the Symphony auction a few years ago. The real stinger for me was it was two bottles of 93 Armand Rousseau Chambertin.
Oh.
No one is bidding on it.
Oh, no.
The best part of the auctions, especially being into, I love German Rieslings.
Yeah.
I love all the sweet stuff.
We cannot go to the same. I've never been to that one because I'm afraid of what I will do there. But we can't go because both of us are just going to bid up the Rieslings.
People are going to bid at these things. The one advantage of going to, something like a Toronto auction is that the pool of people is much smaller than if you go to something in New York.
Yeah.
So that's great. People bid on the same stuff. They leave the champagne. Awesome. I got three bottles of 85 Gose.
Mm-hmm.
Incredible.
Yeah.
And
you got it at a deal. Whatever you paid for it, you got
Got it at a huge, great
way
price.
Way less than what you're going to get.
And all three bottles were incredible. And everyone bids on the Bordeaux. They bid on the Napa. Some of the Italian stuff, but for the most part, they're going after the Bordeaux and they're going after the Napa stuff.
Yeah.
And they're leaving a lot of the Burgundies. That was at this one in particular.
Oh my God.
No one bid. So 93 Chambertin, Armand Rousseau. No one is bidding. And my neighbor's, he's jutting his elbow and he goes, you should put a bid here. It's two lots. And two bottles per lot. So, the way it works is that if you win the first lot, you can apply the same price to the second.
Right. And by the way, for people listening, that wine now, if you got it at...
No. You can't say. Wait. Just wait.
Sorry,
this is part of the story.
Yeah.
No one's bidding.
Yeah.
And so I put up my hand and I think I bid, I don't know, $1,800. I'm making up a number.
Okay. So 900 a bottle.
900 a bottle for 93 Armand Rousseau Chambertin. Yeah. By the way, you can see how excited I'm getting now.
Yeah.
This is clearly a passion of mine. One other guy bids against me, and it's just the two of us. And for whatever reason, I freeze at about $2,500.
Yeah, it's a lot of money.
So it's a lot of money, and I came here not thinking I was buying anything.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, I'm writing a check for $2,500.
Yeah.
I don't do anything, and you don't have a lot of time. And these auctions can go, real, real fast. Anyway, I freeze $2,500. Gavel goes down. Bam. The guy wins. He takes both lots.
Yeah.
Neighbor looks at me and goes, "You are going to regret that. Pull up your phone right now
and
look up how much one of those bottles is on Wine Searcher or in New York."
Yeah.
That guy just took the steal of the night. So now you can say how much. So he paid.
How much? How much? Like, is that each of those bottles would be, I'm going conservative, in American dollars, $5,000 each.
No.
Like,
no, each bottle I think is about $1,500 or no.
It's more than that. Like those, that's expensive wine.
It's expensive. It's expensive wine, and he got an incredible deal.
We'll say that.
He paid better than 50% off. Yeah. Whatever it is.
Oh yeah. Well, what I'm talking about also though, at restaurants. I should clarify. If you were getting a consignment versus at a restaurant. At a restaurant, it's going to be over $5,000 American a bottle.
Yes.
Yeah. No. If you get a consignment, it's going to be less than that. Now, I'm not. You know, I don't have the money to do it. But if I was in that moment, God, I hope I was sober, because I was sober. If I had a couple drinks, I might put a couple bids on for something. Because
I did that on
wine that you
on an 1890 Madeira that for whatever reason I wanted, and I don't even drink that much Madeira, but I got so excited by this 1890 and this 1907 in this. It was an online auction, and I remember just bidding. And the problem with these auctions is you get caught up in the hype, and you get really excited to just. I want it. And you blow way past the price that you said. That's what, you know, the max I'm willing to pay. And I think I yelled out, I end up winning the auction. I win the 1890 and I yelled out of my con. I go, yes, like really, really loud. And then about 4 seconds later, I went,
mother bleeper.
Fuck. Yeah. I went like, fuck. Like, you know, because the reality hits of what did you just do? What did you just spend on a wine you don't even, like literally my most expensive bottle in my cellar is 1890 Madeira. I don't buy Madeira ever. And I'm sure it's going to be incredible and I'll open it at a fun time with friends and probably pair with creme brulee because it's a dessert that I like to make and it's fun and you get to use the torch. But why is that the most expensive bottle in my cellar?
Well, it's history, you know.
There's an allure there of how old it is.
That's part of the thing with wine.
But Burgundy's the thing that I'm chasing. And I don't have anything that's half the price of that 1890 Madeira. Yeah. I'd also love to get some really old Egon Müller Scharzhofburger Spätlese. I mean, that is one of the unicorn wines I've tried. I mean, I guess it's not that hard to find, but it is really special when you taste it.
It's hard to find. And it is
delicious.
It's crazy expensive.
Here's the question.
Yeah.
Is it expensive? Like what defines expensive? I think if you compare it to what Bordeaux's are going for and what Burgundy's are going for, this is a steal.
In that respect,
$200 for like some of the best Riesling in the world?
Yes, under those. Yeah. Oh no, no. Yeah,
under those optics.
Yeah.
It's
under
cheap.
Under those optics is cheap, but it's always such a weird thing talking about wine because a lot of people listening don't spend more than $20-$25 for a bottle. Where going to the LCBO and spending $40 on a bottle is for them once a year. And what I always tell people is, I don't have children. I don't spend money on cars. I don't spend money on technology. Wine is one of the few things I spend my money on. So we all have our own perspective and what I try to do is always try to give people good wines for under $20, which is why, you know, Cremant comes up all the time. Hell, I'll tell you right now, over Christmas, girlfriend's family, they brought over a magnum of
Cremant,
Jackson Triggs Merlot. And you know what? Poured myself a glass. I'm like, you taste like Merlot. You don't taste like Cab, you taste like Merlot. There's not crazy depth on it, but I just looked at the bottle. I'm like, good for you. For the price and for what you're supposed to do, pour me a full glass. I'm going to enjoy this.
I had the Trius Red Blend.
Yeah.
I think over the holidays or a little bit before. It wasn't bad. It was totally, totally fine. And I think I have a problem, and maybe serious wine drinkers have a problem, of sometimes shutting off and saying, this doesn't have to be the most complex thing, and I'm looking for depth and history and prestige in that bottle, and I can just appreciate, it's just, you know, you're out for a social drink, and I'm going to have a glass of red, and I'm going to feel nice and warm and fuzzy inside, and have a good time with my friends, and not be such a dick for an hour.
Oh, man, I'd love to get into that, just about how the friends sometimes, how they perceive you. But by the way, sometimes you're going for the Wagyu. Sometimes you're having the Big Mac combo. Same thing with wine. They all have their place. All right, in 2 minutes, explain to me, in 2 minutes or less, what the hell is blockchain? I have no idea what that term means, but I hear it brought up. I think on one episode of not Stephen Colbert, of the British fellow, John Oliver was talking about it, and I'm like, I don't know what's going on.
So basically, what you have is, instead of one central party maintaining a ledger, So okay. Think of it like an accounting ledger. Your, you know, yep. CIBC or a bank, TD, will be maintaining a ledger. A blockchain is just a way for different people to maintain a copy of the ledger.
Yeah.
And it does it in a way that each page of the ledger is cryptographically related to the one that came before it. And it's done in a way where if there's a bad actor, if you have a group of 10 people who are maintaining this or proposing new pages of the ledger, which they call blocks,
yep.
If there's a bad actor at the table and they try and pull out or falsify some transactions on a page of the ledger that came before it, everyone else who's part of maintaining that chain will know. And they'll know because cryptographically, the links will break.
Okay.
That's part of the big deal here is that you can't falsify transactions.
Oh, okay.
And so when people say, "Who care? Why is Bitcoin a big deal?" The answer is because it's a way, going back to what I said earlier, for unknown parties to trust one another and agree on the state of a ledger or a set of transactions or the state of a world computer in Ethereum without having to know or trust one another. So if you apply that, the big deal again is to money, or if you wanted to have some kind of security or a stock, a guy in Japan who doesn't know me is able to trade with me without having to know who I am, reveal who he is, or having to trust anyone involved in that transaction. The thing that you trusted was the blockchain. The way that, look it up on Wikipedia, the thing that we're trusting, well, not saying that all Wikipedia articles are accurate, but the thing that becomes the middle is Wikipedia.
Yeah.
Between the source and the viewer. The blockchain becomes the state of information that everyone trusts.
So basically, it's an infrastructure creating trust and safety between two different parties that may want to do business.
Correct.
All right. Yes. I think I got a little bit of it. So how annoyed do your friends get? The ones that aren't, like, they aren't big into wine. They enjoy wine, but they're not big into it. When you start waxing poetic about some obscure grape from Etna, or why you need to try this Aglianico, or why, you know, I don't feel like a Saint Estef tonight because I don't want rustic wine. Like when you get the most douchebaggery lines, which, by the way, we're all guilty of.
I think I get away with it because there's passion behind those statements instead of just some.
You're not trying to show off, or it's wine isn't a status symbol.
No, it's for me it's not. I mean, I'm very happy with an Alsatian Riesling that's $20. I love it. In fact, that's one of my go-to whites. It's just a $20 bottle of Alsatian Riesling.
By the way, you might have missed it. I love when Carrie, the interview with her, she talked about how Alsatian Riesling is meaner than Moselle Riesling. And I'm like, perfect. That perfectly describes
it. She would say something like that.
Yeah.
And I was actually about to reference Carrie because I was on a date about a year ago, and the girl told me she knew a lot about wine, and then she ordered some whatever Zinfandel, mm-hmm. and I wanted to joke to her at the table. I didn't because I just said, this won't go over well. But I wanted to joke to her, you can order that wine, but it's on a separate bill. That you can pay for. And I'm only mentioning Carrie here because I figure everyone else will slam me for a comment like that.
Yeah.
Carrie would be the one person who would go, that's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
That would be the right move.
There's a small percentage in the wine world that applauds you, and then everyone else goes, douchebag. Unless that wine, Helen Turley, Robert Bialy, there are some Ridge. There are a lot of good Zinfandel producers out there. I will defend the Zin when done right.
So I think going back to what I was, or the original question.
About your friends going, shut up.
They don't really give me a hard time because I see wine as this thing that's meant to be shared. And I want to share with them the experience or the expression in the glass. Boy, that sounds bad. Yeah. The thing that I'm so excited about in the glass is the thing that I want to share with people. And I feel fortunate that I was part of this production company that kind of started me on this journey. And then whatever was inside of me that said, go down this path and follow that passion and discover it and learn about it. And I'm very lucky that I get to travel a lot in my life. And get to visit these wine regions and learn about whatever wine's out there. And a lot of people just haven't had someone who can say, hey, come on this journey with me, or let me just show you why this is different than that.
Yeah.
And I think my friends appreciate that. I'm excited to share with them things. I have no problem opening. I do once a month-ish dinner parties here, 8 to 10 people, and I'll open 15 to 16 bottles, and they're all interesting. They're all great, and I'll say, what do you think about it? I'm not offended. If you don't like it, totally cool. But I'm excited to let people try, hey, what is Hermitage Blanc? Most people...
Delicious.
Well, the answer is delicious. That's correct. But I opened a bottle of... Recently, first of all, that 85 Gose champagne, mm-hmm. I opened for a group of people, and watching people's eyes light up and seeing, oh, there's barely any bubbles left in this thing. It's softened out and it's rounded out and it's caramelly and it's vanilla. And it's like, what is going on in this, you know, in quotes, champagne?
Yeah.
People are, their only comments are, I've never had anything like this before. And it kind of triggers, I think, the light bulb for them as well of, maybe there's more going on in this world than I've been exposed to.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is what they appreciate, is that someone is willing to share with them that experience. And I opened, I think, in that same night, a Beaucastel Blanc. And it wasn't old. It was the 2015. So, yeah. You know, it's come back in 15
but
years.
But also very rare for the listener, very rare. When Chateau Beaucastel, obviously Chateauneuf-du-Pape. When you think Chateauneuf-du-Pape, usually you're going to think red, you know, and the Grenache, Mourvèdre, Syrah, and all the other ones that can or cannot be there. But yeah, the white stuff is great. It's so cool and different and tangy and all this stuff going on, but you just don't drink it often.
And people like, I mean, they're just kind of two camps for what most people drink in white. They're either doing a Napa Chardonnay, or they're going Pinot Grigio, and then there's not much else that kind of falls in between.
Yeah.
And so for the Chardonnay lovers, who you just pour them a glass of Beaucastel Blanc, right? It's pretty rich. It's creamy. It's rounded. It's done in
oak. Oh, it's going to be catnip. It's going to be great.
Right. And everyone at that table, I didn't tell them what it was. I just poured it for them. And you saw a couple of people who asked me, they said, What is this?
Yeah, what the hell's going on here?
What is going on here? Because I know that this isn't Chardonnay. It's super interesting. It's super tasty. That to me is fun. That to me is what this is all about, is sharing with people the stories of what's in those bottles and what gets me excited, and seeing that they get excited too. And maybe they'll later say, hey, can you recommend for me some wines that, you know, what can I buy for $15 to $30?
Yeah.
I think that's one question I want to get to in a half second, which is kind of the different price points of what you can buy at what level. But that was what was exciting for me with these dinner parties in particular, is opening these bottles and sharing that with friends and exposing them to grapes or regions that they probably wouldn't try or find on their own. And I had someone do that for me. I had this neighbor who I mentioned, who we were at the auction together, and he exposed me to a lot of great stuff. And I'm very fortunate to have had someone like that in my life who could show me those things that Carrie could say to me, hey, try this sherry thing. Just see what you think.
Yeah.
Go home, try it and see what you think. My neighbor did that with me all the time. I remember he opened on my birthday one year, a few different things, but one in particular was a Guigal, I don't remember the year, but it was a Guigal. It wasn't one of the Lalas. It is called, what sits in between?
Are we talking about just one of the Hermitage? One of the...
totally blanking right now.
And this is something we'll remember right when this ends.
Anyway.
It's like a sports podcast I do. I'm like, David West! I didn't remember until the moment after the podcast
ended. So, it is Coro T.
Yeah.
And it's kind of between
the... So, just one of the single vineyard, like a Bressard's, Bressands, just one of the single vineyard Coro T's.
Driving me nuts that I can't remember it.
You'll remember it. We got to end this soon. You'll remember the moment we're done.
So, the point is, I tried it, and it was the first time I ever had, first of all, a Coro T. So, you know, Northern Rhone, Syrah, but in Coro T, they're blending a bit of Viognier in.
Yep.
And I remember just smelling it, and I don't even think I tasted it. I just looked at him and said, what the heck is this?
Yeah, what's going on?
And he goes, what do you think?
Yep.
I said, that is crazy awesome. It smells like bacon fat and rose petals in a glass. He goes, welcome to Northern Rhone, in Coro T. And just every time you try something, and if you, especially if you have the vocabulary to identify what's special and going on in that glass, it's so exciting to go, wow, I had no idea that this was out there, that these smells and flavors could be in a wine.
So what you're doing for your friends and what your neighbor did for you, same thing happened to me when I just fell in love with wine. And hopefully, I like that. What you're trying to do is to get people to come onto your journey, which is kind of the point, and we got to wrap up, kind of the point of this podcast is just come on the journey of wine. And if I can help you with your journey, great. You ain't going to take the same path I did, nor would you want to. You got to take your own path. From I can recommend good box wine to Jackson Triggs to to Latash and everything in between.
And that's the fun that I want to just add to is people shouldn't be afraid to ask the somm at a restaurant, hey, I typically drink this.
Yeah.
What do you recommend on your list that's a little bit different, but knowing the profile of things I typically like, what do you recommend?
Yeah.
And not being afraid to ask those questions. Wine just for whatever reason has this kind of intimidation built into it. Maybe the words are hard to pronounce, the list is hard to read, but if you talk to people and you show that you're genuinely curious and want to know more, people are so happy to answer questions and say, oh, try this. Maybe it'll be maybe a little bigger. It'll be less big. It'll be rounder. It'll be oakier. Whatever it is, ask them. Yeah. They're very happy. That's what they're there for. That is their job, is to help you navigate that list. And I think if people aren't afraid, they'll start realizing, oh, I actually really like that Chilean cab that I never tried before. That's real, like Sina Chadwick.
Yes.
I had no idea what this was. Someone just gave it to me blind, and I went, that was the most interesting wine at this table tonight. And he goes, here's what it is. And I went, that is awesome.
Brian, thank you so much for doing the pod. It's funny. So many things you've said are things I've said in many podcasts in the past. It's supposed to be fun. Don't be intimidated. Go on your journey. Try. Ask questions. Stuff you love. There's going to be stuff you hate. And really appreciate it. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, everywhere good podcasts are sold, you will be able to find this. Please rate, review, and tell your friends. And until next time, happy hunting.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.